duties, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
Wow, Fireside Chatters. Just wow. Welcome to THC, drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke from sunny San Diego. I'm Greg Carlwood, fresh off the Don Peyote tour bus with Dan Fogler, Freeman Fly, Jamie Hanshaw, and Ron Patton of Paranoia Magazine. It was an amazing adventure. I tripped acid for the first time in the Redwoods of Big Sur, which went to some scary places after between 4 and 5 hits, depending on how you score it. It was wild, and I went to hell and back, quite honestly, people. But there are so many great stories and videos from the trip, and I think I'm going to try and put a little video together where I can really go through the details of it. It should be fun. But I know you people have been hungry for a new show, and I'm sorry I broke my every 5-day covenant so soon, but it really was a once-in-a-lifetime kind of thing, and I needed to get out of the house. But here we are, you lovely party people, and a great talk with Xavier Hayes, who's written extensively about the Shemsu Hor, who just might be the first secret society behind ancient Egypt, possibly reptilian even. He has also investigated the claims of fuckery surrounding the deaths of Elvis and Michael Jackson and made some really interesting connections that we touched on in the second half of the show. But I love this interview and I love this book and the subject matter, so I hope you enjoy, people. We have a money bomb next episode, so get those donations in. We're slightly behind where I'd like to be, but another 100 or so would really get us pretty much there. So consider throwing down and hopefully you'll be this round's winner or at least contribute to someone else's needs who we'll talk to on the next show. Also consider the new subscription tab where you can donate $5, $10, or $20 monthly. I know this is a huge deal. It would be amazing for people to do that, but there are a lot of shows out there that are $5 or $10 a month just to get access to the stuff that I already give you. So consider that if you're able and willing. So let's do this, people. Reptilians, Akhenaten, Elvis, Michael Jackson, the Martian materials and the Great Pyramids of Egypt, dinosaurs, the Shemsu Hor, and much more. And I'll see you on the other side. Alright people, if you're paying attention, it should be obvious that the ruling elite have been carefully crafting a framework of reality that reduces people to mere hamsters on the unfulfilling wheel of economic slavery and total thought control. But many people wonder where this all began, and though it's hard to get a conclusive answer from a notoriously secret cabal, many of their symbols and tributes lead one to suggest something about ancient Egypt is very important. Well, today's guest, Xavier Hayes, has written a book entitled Aliens in Ancient Egypt, The Brotherhood of the Serpent and the Secrets of the Nile Civilization that follows these breadcrumbs back to the original secret society that today's elite might still be emulating. And stranger still, they may have learned their techniques for controlling from the background from an otherworldly species of reptilians. I love the book, and I'm psyched to have him here. Xavier Hayes, how the hell are you, man?
Doing pretty good. How is it going there in California?
Excellent, man. Never better. I can never complain about sunny San Diego. But man, you know, I really did enjoy the book, and it goes in quite a few places that I wouldn't have thought, but to get us started, let's dive into ancient Egypt. I've had many guests from many different weird areas of life, and whether you're talking about occult magicians or Freemasons or Bilderberg journalists, if you follow some of this modern fringe material back, all these subjects that seem wildly different lead back to ancient Egypt. So clearly something's up. But let's try to walk through some of this chronologically, man. Before the Shemsu Hor, which we're definitely going to talk about, things seemed to be going pretty well in Egypt, didn't they?
Well, yeah, Egypt, as you know, was the root of most of what we refer to as occult knowledge and most all of the symbolism used by the Illuminati and secret societies through the ages stems from this culture. So if we can say that it was going very well before the Shemsu Hor period, that's debatable because, you know, what we know of the actual Egyptian the pyramids and the Giza field, all that's way before. So the Egyptians themselves left records, and like, they inherited this high advanced degree of civilization.
Right. When I think about Egypt as we know it, you know, the time of pharaohs and all the symbols we see, that is it seems to be that's where civilization picked up after this big cataclysm, which I've heard you say before and a lot of guests suggest, and I'm inclined to think that, you know, as time is cyclical, it seems like disasters, cataclysms happen throughout history. It's just kind of something that happens, and it seems like the last one that everyone talks about was a big flood, and Egypt seems to be, you know, the setup of society post-flood. I mean, is that pretty accurate?
Absolutely, because before the flood, there was other golden ages, and you know, who's to say how old? Definitely, right. The pyramids weren't built. You know, has tombs for the pharaoh Khufu. That's ridiculous. After the flood, like everything else, right? You rebuild, and it takes, you know, hundreds of thousands of years to get up to speed to everything. But we do know that the pyramids themselves, when the first explorers in the early 1800s started coming over and going into the pyramids off of Watkins and some of the preeminent scholars from England, they found evidence of seawater, salt, encrusted within the pyramids, detailing that it had been submerged. And you could find all kinds of seashells and stuff.
And that's something I was curious about, because the pyramids, you know, there's a lot of debate over when they were built and why they were built. And you seem to think that it was at least in this previous golden age, and that it was built with more of a positive purpose in mind, right?
Yeah, and it's funny because they just had a whole new, like last week, a new article talking about, oh, we think we know how the pyramids were built with like wet sand and this and that, which is fun, but they don't explain the massive megalithic blocks that make up the core of these crazy structures. You know, they never seem to mention that part. I think there's been plenty of lost world type, Atlantean type civilizations, more than one for sure, and maybe even of different species as well. We're barely starting to understand who we are. I mean, we're to the point now where the awakening has come so fast, right?
Right.
And this goes into the elite's plans, like the Archons or the Illuminati or whatever you want to call them. Their goal is to turn, because they're not even human, they hate us. I'm convinced 100% that it's an alien presence that has no, it's not human at all. It's not concerned with the soul.
Right.
And they're trying to steer us towards the transhumanist agenda, right? So we happen to be in this path where right in the middle of the global awakening and being on the precipice of this transhumanist transformation, that we have the ability to actually stop or delay this old ancient plan.
Right. Well, I wanted to talk about the purpose of the pyramids, because I've heard a lot of different claims, everything from it simulated a psychedelic out-of-body experience for those who took some type of initiation, and then I've heard people suggest it was a free energy device. But you know, in the book you talk about it being, you think it was there to raise the consciousness level of the people. Maybe it emitted some type of frequency that was more harmonic. But what brought you to that type of conclusion? Because I'm really curious about what the pyramids were for.
Yeah, I think it's a twofold question, twofold answer, excuse me. The purpose, I think maybe initially, eons ago, because I think as long as the land formations have remained this way, this where the Giza Plateau is, where that field is, just being situated perfectly, mm-hmm. you know, like everywhere, I think there's always been some sort of pyramid field or pyramid structure there, no matter how millions of years back. It could be seen from space as well, so you have, even maybe if there was a beam of light or something, sort of like a homing device for other species when they entered this solar system. I think later on, it became more of a universe, a field, like the pyramid field became a machine, of course, but to uplift consciousness, to keep man elevated during times of the Silver Age and the descending, you know. And I think it all works with the way the water is and the way the different stones and the quartz crystals and, you know, even Christopher Dunn has shown how, you know, certain, like insulin, certain parts of the pyramid act like insulin for electricity. And I think that's what it was. And unfortunately, with decommissions after the last great flood.
Yeah. I'll always be fascinated with the Great Pyramids. I mean, they're definitely interesting. And I had never really been sure how they were made, and I'm still not, but when I read Philip Coppin's last book, and I never really got to talk about this much on the air because I had Philip on once before and we had kept in touch, and he sent me his next book that he had wrote. We scheduled the interview, and just a few minutes before, he calls and says that he can't do it because he hasn't been feeling well and he's on his way to urgent care. Well, I guess he was diagnosed with cancer at that point, and he never really came back out of the hospital. And he died there. Definitely sad and a tragic loss. But in that book, he sold me on the building methods of the pyramids being something called geopolymers. And you wrote about it a bit too. And can you tell the people what that is? It's kind of like concrete, right? But it's a more advanced form.
It's a form of concrete for sure. But it's the way it's the what makes it interesting is that what the geopolymers in this formula, they have a mass abundance that's only found on Mars. So it's kind of strange.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what's that about? And then what does Cairo mean Mars? And plus all the other weird stuff about the red planet that we're just kind of, it looks like the remnants of a civilization that was destroyed, you know?
It does.
And so it's crazy. So yeah, I think, and you know, Philip, I was speaking with him too before he passed. I didn't get to talk to him as much as I wanted to, unfortunately. But yeah, that and I think I even might even learn that from him as well, because that's the work of a French geologist.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, definitely, and that's some stuff they've been suppressing for a while.
So yeah, the mentioning of these the composition of some of the materials and the stones that were used are more common with rocks from Mars. Like, that is super fascinating, and it's hard to really reconcile that with our current conventional viewing of history. So, I mean, is it these elements that are in the rocks, or these types of rocks, the composition? Is it not found anywhere on the Earth? Is it pretty conclusive that they are Martian rocks, or is it not quite that obvious?
Yeah, it's not as abundant, actually. You know, and this is from NASA reports, which is even stranger, you know?
Right.
So, it seems to be that to be able to make the concrete with the megalithic block building, somehow they're able to, you know, make this concrete with this abundance, like this Martian silica. And it's obvious that it would make sense if it was dematerialized to the point where it was softened and then formed back in shape. Because there's, and you could see this in Peru, not only Egypt, you know, there's a few places where you could see the rocks look like locking together, you know, like these megalithic stones,
yeah,
like locking together perfectly. You can't even fit a hair through. And it absolutely makes no sense at all. It's like Play-Doh or something. It just defies logic. So, and the fact that these things exist in the Earth and they're not concerned to the point of, you know, having massive press conferences and trying to figure out how this was done is really, really upsetting.
So yeah, we have this time, this golden age before this flood, where people are building structures that are using technologies we don't have today, or supposedly don't have today. They're using rocks from another planet, which seems foreign to us in 2014, how that could be possible. I mean, it seems like wild times, man. And this is all this technology, this ability to do such things. I mean, this is all speculated to be handed down to us from some non-human species, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There was an alien element in ancient times. I mean, maybe even two or three, who knows. But yeah, for sure, because all the records, you know, they're all fascinated and obsessed with flying vehicles and the Vimanas, and as the Hindu and the ancient Indian texts talk about, you know, it's when Columbus came, you know, the first question the Indians asked him was, you know, are you from the sky? You know?
Yeah.
So, well, what is this expression? You know, it's insane.
And this is an interesting time, this, like, flood time, because this is when many native cultures, you know, the Hindu, the Hopi, the Mayans, Amazonian tribes, we hear these stories of other beings taking these groups of people deep inside caves and caverns and helping them wait it out before taking them back to the surface. I mean, it's kind of weird that different pockets of civilization from other sides of the globe have these similar stories. You know, that's pretty trippy.
Yeah, and then you have all the underground cave systems that are found all over the world, too.
Yeah.
Tunnel systems in Turkey and South America. And, you know, even when I talk about the reptilian, you know, the whole mythology of G.I. Joe is actually, you know, was about all of this. It's kind of
right.
funny, you know?
Right.
Serpentor, you know, the Cobra, you know. You know, thanks for subliminally implanting that into my, you know, 5-year-old mind. But
yeah, me too. So,
but I talk about the interesting aspect of that theory as related to the Shems of Hor, ancient Egypt, in that the reptilian, let's just say, like with some of the Jewish mythologies, and they talk about the Adam and Eve, right?
Mm-hmm.
Adam and Eve myth. Now, one of the Jewish texts talks about, you know, that the serpent wasn't, you know, on the ground. He was actually upright, walking, and intelligent. And you know, there are a lot of other mythologies, like in the Mayans, also talk about the upright, intelligent, walking serpent, you know, giving them knowledge as well. So here, in this ancient Hebrew text, talks about, you know, the upright, intelligent serpentine being who was the first to have been given the knowledge, right,
mm-hmm.
of the aliens or the Elohim or whatever you want to call them. And then at one point, he rebelled, and he made Adam and Eve aware of what was going on.
Right.
You know, with the fruit of knowledge, you know. So he was chopped up. And like his limbs, and like the symbol they use, like for he was punished for like the, you know, cut his legs and arms off and the slither on the blowfish of his life.
Right.
To go underground, right? So, you know, that the idea of the upright walking serpent is prevalent in all cultures in ancient times, and who's to say that it didn't evolve here as well? You know, there could be there's a geologist. Dr. Russell, I can't remember his first name, you know, he talks about the Troodon dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
How the Troodon dinosaur had the biggest brain of all the dinosaurs at that point in time. And if it had survived the extinction level, you know, whatever the comment was supposed about the dinosaur, which didn't wipe everything out because we still have, you know, lizards and Komodo dragons and weird stuff like
exactly,
that.
Exactly,
right? So say for a chance that the Troodon dinosaur survived all that. That means just with evolution, his brain would have advanced rapidly than any humanoid or anything else we've ever seen. You know, who's to say that it couldn't have gained intelligence on its own or had been visited by another species or even another reptilian race? Because they're starting to figure out that if life evolved on the planets, like the first thing that will probably evolve will be reptilians. Right? I mean, the stem of our brain is reptilian.
Yeah, if they're the oldest, it would only make sense that they would evolve first.
Exactly. So who's to say that these didn't, you know? So you don't necessarily have to look to an outside alien race, you know, to talk about the reptilians. You just talk about they could have evolved here. And then maybe they got some knowledge from a visiting race. Well, who's to say?
Yeah, that's a great
you know,
point.
Right, I mean, I don't know. I wasn't there. You know, everyone here that was not there, so you can't say it's right or wrong, but it's interesting to theorize and just talk and shoot the crap about it and, you know, just to build. And I think that's what's important is not to say you're crazy or this and that. So, like, say, no, you're crazy because you only believe one certain thing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to flesh out this story a little more, the flood ushers in this dark age and thrusts humanity into chaos, and then we find civilization is rebooted in ancient Egypt, and we have the earliest writings of the first pharaoh, and this is kind of seems where the Shems of Hor enter the story, at least in the forefront. You know, maybe they are Maybe they go back farther than humanity goes back, you know, but this is kind of where, as far as the modern age, since the flood, it seems like they had an influence in this first Egyptian society. Are they the ones who structured it with banks and pharaohs and priest classes and courts?
Yeah, I believe that the pharaoh, you know, who himself claims to be related to God, you know, part of the sky god. And even in the, what's funny is that you want to be an Egyptologist, right? So you spend 4 years, you know, study this history of Egypt, and you're basically going off the Manetho list, and that basically says that's the king's list, the pharaonic king's list. However, to the Palermo stone and other tablets found in Syria, it's basically confirmed that the king's list also has the ancient, like, pre-pharaonic sky gods king's list as well, that they don't bother to tell you about.
Right.
You know, like, you teach it from here, but don't worry about that. So, like, it's all over in the records in ancient Egypt. So, yes, the... let's ask your question again.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the structures that they put in place for their society are the same structures we have now in ours, you know, banks and priest classes and courts. And this is the type of structure that kind of keeps the common man down and keeps the common man in line. And, you know, it's interesting that you can trace this back to these Shemsu Hor, which seemed to be one of the first secret societies, one of the first organizations to rule from the shadows while people are given a figurehead leader like a pharaoh or a president. And
exactly.
Yeah, it just seems like we're modeling after that group.
Exactly. The Babylon banking system hasn't changed in 5,000 years. You know, they come in, they came in at a time, most prevalently during Akhenaten's grandfather's, great grandfather's time, Thutmose III, who had a UFO encounter and, you know, wrote about it. And it's there. On the temple walls, they suppress it, you know, the Tulu Pirates, which supposedly talks about it, you know, governments have, you know, been killing each other for decades trying to figure this out and read down the exact copy of it. But, yeah, we know for sure that, you know, there was this encounter. And, you know, when the Shemsu Hor comes in, they go behind the scenes, right? So it's the pharaoh is the puppet leader, and then you have, it's all bloodline related, of course, you know. So then you have the Amun priesthood, and this is where they start just working out the kinks, figuring out the banking system. During this time, it's to get, you know, you're obsessed with the underworld and, you know, all of the little trinkets you got to buy, right? You know, you got to have
this
little god and that god, and then, you know, you got to get your cat mummified, right? You know, all these things, and this is basically the start of this type of system. And so which makes it, that's what makes Pharaoh Akhenaten important, because he was an insider. You know, he was of the bloodline. You know, he was like Justin Bieber. He was a huge teenage celebrity, right? And he wasn't expected to go out of line. Well, something happened where, you know, his great aunt, I believe Queen Hatshepsut, was, you know, giving him this knowledge, and he was, you know, he had sisters, and he was, you know, surrounded by the pharaonic and the tradition of the matriarchal tradition, which was ancient Egypt's original rule, which is the female rule, and being too much the masculine and feminine, like all men were, right?
Yeah.
So it's, which is important even today, like, you know, looking about how bombarded we are with everything that's going on. I mean, plus the whole, you know, the how the women are treated, like, basically. And, you know, you may think that it's more equal or whatever now, and in a sense it is, but at the same time, the role of feminism was created by the CIA, destroyed the family, and, you know.
Yeah.
And it's we're living in the craziest time. So even back then, they were already going to the Shemsu Hor, already manipulating the king rule, right? The warrior. See, now this is the era of the warrior king and the warrior rule. And I think this is what Queen Hatshepsut was worried about, and trying to impart the knowledge of matriarchal heresy to hierarchy to Akhenaten, who's still young, you know, he's still young enough to get this, right? And for her reward, you know, she went on a camping trip and never returned. So eventually, you know, the kid kind of woke up and was really like the first dude in history to put the money masters out of business.
Yeah, and I thought that was super interesting because you kind of draw this analogy, you know, the same way that people claim JFK was our last real president before the secret societies really cemented their control and they haven't had to loosen their grip since. Yeah, it seems like there's sort of a parallel with Akhenaten and the way secret societies in Egypt, he was fighting them. But and also when you talk to Egyptologists and you look back at Akhenaten and his memorials, it seems like in most cases his face has been scratched off and they've tried to kind of erase him from history.
Oh yeah, they tried. Yeah, almost did. Like we have very little of his record, and just especially from the Amar period. There's enough, you know, that makes it unique in all of the world's history. So yeah, they definitely try to get rid of him.
And there is a little speculation also that was done, you know, and you know, you've taught me that it's there's a good chance that it was done because of his policies and him fighting the secret cabal. But there's a lot of speculation out there that it was also due to him looking different, due to him being some type of hybrid or having an elongated skull and being maybe part alien, and that they wanted to cover that up as well. So,
absolutely, because I mean, there's no art in history that shows that. Like literally, nowhere in the world that we have this.
Yeah.
Except his. Like he's painting, showing his daughters, you know, in their form with elongated skulls, right?
Yeah. So
that's some serious ish right there, man. So, and.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting to think about, you know, him being one of the first people to seriously fight back. And I wonder what was going on with this, you know, this Shemsu Hor group, and if they were really a reptilian race, you know, maybe they were blending their race with the pharaohs to kind of like engineer themselves in a different way. It's tough to know, but you've speculated that this reptilian group has somehow, those reptilian traits, for the most part, at least in the physical sense, have been kind of weeded out genetically over the years, right?
Yeah, and I think that it's possible that what we know is the elongated skull, that might actually even be the reptilian skull.
Yeah.
You know? You know, that's a good one to think about, because you know, who knows, right? But yeah, I think for sure that the physical traits, because you know, you can read 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, they're, you know, fighting like reptilian dragons, and you know, even Lord Byron, the famous poet, supposedly had like horns and hid reptilian features, right? So I think at this point, I think that's gone. Except if it exists, it'd be at a level that, like above Rothschild level, like such an unknown elite that you would need to know about it. Right? Mm-hmm. Can you imagine that? Like, there's more. There's got to be. If the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, and we're worried about them, can you imagine who we're not worried about that we don't even know? You know?
Yeah, man. It's trippy.
Absolutely. It's crazy.
And now another aspect of Egyptian culture that I never really got was mummification. And I guess I just always wrote it off as sort of a superstitious thing they did. But we give them so much credit for being advanced in other areas that it doesn't really make sense to just conclude that. And you've looked into this, and there seems to be more to it, doesn't there?
Yeah, the mummification is really weird. I mean, that's, to me, you don't mummify yourself. You know, why would you mummify your physical self if you're not expecting a physical return?
That's a good point.
I mean, that's kind of how I looked at it, right? I mean, you know, you worry about the underworld and the other part and all that stuff, or, you know, that's what doesn't even make sense. Like, you're worried about returning in the physical realm and you're making sure you're still there. And I think for those thoughts to exist and those type of beliefs, there has to have been some sort of cloning or, you know, or a knowledge of this type of understanding, because there's no other way to look at it. And plus, hybrid species, like, there's all kinds of even when you look at the famous light bulb, it's actually a serpent, and the other panels are taken, it's like a little arm, they're assembling, it looks like they're making serpents.
Yeah.
Baby serpents, and they're assembling humans. I mean, it's insane, or hybriding. And some of the original, I have in the books, some of the earliest, like hieroglyphs and earliest Egyptian art talks about like weird hybrid winged creatures from the desert in Egypt and stuff. And these are from the Mass Parallel collection, and these are very rare. And I have actually have the books from the 1800s, and you know the plates in there, they're nuts. You know?
Well, you know, in the same way that transhumanists, that whole conspiracy today is that they're trying to transport their consciousness into computers to live forever. Maybe in ancient Egypt, there's a parallel with these reptilians resurrecting their consciousness in a human vessel to appear less frightening to the masses, yet still be insanely superior and being able to rule them without blowing their cover.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, that's
it's out there, man. And I don't know if you're familiar with Freeman Fly, but he's a conspiracy researcher, and he's got this little thread that he has gathered this evidence that seems to be mounting up, anecdotal evidence that seems to suggest that Obama could be a clone of Akhenaten. And he goes in for all his reasons why, but something that's interesting about Obama is now that his hair has gone gray, you notice he's got a huge scar on his head. And that's like, of all the vetting of a new president, you would think that a 4-inch, 5-inch scar on someone's head would come up, but it never did. And you know, maybe they resurrected Akhenaten and then had to shrink that cranium down to human size.
Well, yeah, I talk about that in the book, actually, a little bit. You know, I like Freeman. He's funny, and he's original. He's a cool guy. But, Akhenaten and Obama, that's a whole other issue. You know, like, Queen Ty looks exactly like his wife, mm-hmm. You know? So, you know, it's freaky. I mean, I the whole scar on the head thing, I mean, is that Photoshop? Is that... is double,
right.
Like, who knows? I mean, Obama, that guy, if he's one thing, he's a master CIA agent, for sure. I mean, or he's, you know, Pharaoh Akhenaten recloned 5 different times, you know? He could be like 5 different Akhenaten clones passing as a president.
Yeah,
you know, it wouldn't be... Hey, let me tell you something, man. Like, nothing surprises me anymore, because I've gone so far down the rabbit hole that it's just like, okay, that...
I hear you. And dude, another fascinating story, a part of your book that I really loved was the examination of modern culture and these references to reptilian royalty. Of course, you mentioned G.I. Joe is always fighting Cobra Commander. Mario is always fighting Bowser and the King Koopa royal family. But the example that I found most fascinating in your book was the underlying threads in that 90s sitcom Dinosaurs. I think a lot of people would remember that show.
Oh.
But tell them about the subtext in that show.
Yeah, that blew my mind, man. Like, that whole part. And I remember that show as a kid. You know, it was a cool show. But when I watched it later on, I'm like, oh, okay. Something else is going on here. You know, that's basically talking about Jim Henson talking about the dinosaurs didn't actually all die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And here's the reptilian overlord, you know, and what's crazy about it is Disney, you know, Disney tried to get the Muppets control from him. He wouldn't sell it. Like they let him create the dinosaur show, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he wouldn't give up control of Muppets. So then they just, you know, hit him with a heart attack gun and he died before the dinosaur show even aired.
Yes, I thought that was a fascinating thread.
But very interesting. And you know, to the chagrin of his soul, wherever it may be, they got the rights to the Muppets anyway. So.
Mm-hmm. And Disney's behind a lot of creepiness. Yeah, it's crazy. The other aspect that was cool was the main family in Dinosaurs. They're the Sinclair family. And that is the name of one of the elite Illuminati supposed bloodlines, is the Sinclairs or the Saint Clairs. And it's also interesting that, you know, anyone who's seen the Sinclair gas station has seen the dinosaur logo. That's their logo for the gas station. And we know that these secret societies, these elites, these bankers, they're involved in banking and they're involved in natural resources, mainly oil. So funny to see that connection.
Yeah, and their logo for the gas station was the big dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, which I thought was great because I remember seeing that, thinking, "Wow, that's cool," you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've always been fast. Everyone is faster than a dinosaur, especially as a kid.
Hell yeah, man!
So
I grew up in this small little Missouri town, and there was really nothing going on in this little suburb. But there was a Sinclair station in the middle of the town. They had the dinosaur. You know, you could go up and sit on it, and that was, I guess, the highlight of a kid's day.
I remember seeing those. I remember seeing those in California and stuff. But,
and who would?
Yeah, and it's weird that you don't see too many Sinclair gas stations anymore, do you now?
No. And who would have thought that years later I would be drawing the connection to the Sinclair gas station, to the show I was probably watching at the time, to elite families and throughout history that have been controlling the masses? I would. My mind would have been blown if I had told myself that back then.
Yeah, that's why the Eureka moment's never ending, you know?
Yeah.
It's just the continual, like, what?
The secular nature of time. But it is a fascinating tale and a great book. But I wanted to talk about a few pieces from your blog before I let you go, because we're getting kind of deep in the interview. But you've written some really interesting pieces that examine the idea of a couple major celebrities might have faked their deaths. And these kind of stories are always fun. But let's look at Elvis. I mean, that theory has been around for quite some time. I've always heard super fans suggesting that he might have faked his death. But what do you think, man? Is it possible? Is there enough evidence out there to make you wonder?
Yeah, you know, the Elvis faking his own death thing kind of went viral, and I had to write a book about it, and it's coming out in December with David Childress, David Patrick Childress, and his own limited press.
Nice.
So they got it about it. Yeah, it's cool, man. I'm stoked about it. So it's going to be out for Christmas. And yeah, first of all, you know, I didn't know anything about Elvis, really, you know. You know, he was more of the caricature of pop culture, you know, like the kung fu.
Yeah.
Like, that type of image to me. Like, I think a lot of people have it, especially this generation, because, you know, we're not even close. He died before I was born, so it doesn't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but to learn about Elvis, it was great. And it was so amazing. Like, he was the man, for sure. Like, his story is incredible. But, yeah, you know, looking into all this conspiracy stuff and Diddy figures on death, I think there's a 20% chance he actually pulled it off, for sure. There's enough weird things that don't make sense to allude to that he might have gotten away with it. However, if, you know, he's still alive or how long, you know, who knows? But he definitely could have got away with it, you know. And this is before the internet, so you know, even Tupac. If you look at the Tupac death, right? There's a lot of weird stuff that, you know, alludes to maybe he even faked his own death as well. And that was before the internet as well, before it really got crazy. So, you know, it's possible, too.
Well, given...
Then you look into Michael Jackson.
Yeah, yeah.
And Michael Jackson, you know, the ultimate, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember where I was when I heard Michael Jackson died. I couldn't even, like, believe it. You know, I think it was one of those, everyone in the world was like, what? Let me check that out. To the point where I almost destroyed the internet, you know?
Yeah. And
took the internet down.
And I wanted to talk to you about him a little bit too, but going back to Elvis, you know, given what I've heard now from so many different researchers and looked into about MKUltra mind control and celebrities like Britney Spears and Miley Cyrus being these mentally fragmented victims of childhood abuse that are then thrown out there to the masses in a dance puppet dance kind of way and just used to siphon wealth. In that context, you look at Elvis and you're like, there is a guy who descended into madness in his later years in the same way, in the self-destructive way that some of these other celebrities do. And it makes you wonder if he wasn't one of the first test cases for mass success for these mind-controlled celebrities.
He was a prototype, but he wasn't himself a victim, you know, in that regard. Like, you know, he was in the army. Like, he was blowing up. Like, he came out of nowhere, basically, and they weren't prepared.
Right.
Like, they had never seen anything like that. I mean, he was self-made. I mean, he didn't steal, you know, black culture, any of that. He was the real deal. I mean, he was from, you know, Tulipo, Mississippi. You know, he was poor as hell. I mean, he was in Memphis as a teenager. Like, literally, he walked across the street to, you know, from the projects to watch B.B. King play the blues on Beale Street, right? I mean, he was the real deal. So, you know, when he was in the Army, that's, you know, they always make the case, well, okay, they could have broken him down there or introduced him to those mind control techniques, which they were just starting out with in the time, in the 50s, right? But there's nothing, there's no real evidence to see any of that other than he was introduced to amphetamines to keep him awake. Now, that's one part of it. The other part is that his mother had just died. Now, we all know through the Illuminati and the satanic rituals, stuff like that, the sacrifices and this and that, you know?
Yep.
However, if it was sacrifice or if it happens naturally, they latch onto this and they use this in school as a tool, right? So his mental state definitely was right for the picking with definitely his mother and being introduced to amphetamines and being in the Army. But I really don't see anything that they might have tried in certain, you know, maybe to get with him, but he was real. Like, he, you know, he forego all of, because they wanted to do was get him in there and do USO tours and just, like, you know, get a bunch of free stuff. Mm-hmm. And to his credit and to the manager of genius of the colonel, he was like, nope, you know, he's going to be a grunt like everybody else. He was smart because that gave him the respect of the older people, right?
Right.
So now he returns and, you know, he's Frank Sinatra, you know, coming home and he's doing, like, singing ballads and doing movies. And he blew up. But the whole thing is, later on, it was the drug abuse. It was the pills, basically. Because, you know, creative people on their cells have trouble sleeping, right?
Yep.
So imagine, you know, mass success, fame, movies, concerts, back-to-back concerts, doing, you know, like, you can't sleep. And, like, the adrenaline, the whole thing that's going around, it becomes, you know, it's just too much. So you kind of require the aid of sleeping pills and some of these things. And his point, you know, he just became so, you know, dependent on these drugs and then doing them. He was like an expert, you know. He was like pharmaceutical, walking pharmaceutical company, you know. Basically, he killed himself into oblivion, and his mental state, of course, deteriorates, but at the same time, he was a seeker. You know, he was reading. He was one of us, man. This blew my mind on ourselves, right? To learn all this and to know that he was like me, like, in the sense where, you know, he was reading all the stuff that I've read. Like, he was, you know, when Shirley MacLaine interviewed me, you know, it was amazing because she was one of the first to kind of go out on a limb and talk about these, you know, these sort of crazy topics and such a high position, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So for Elvis to read in The Travels of Kirshner Moody while he's been having to go read this crappy, like, Lion from Clambake, it's just like, whoa, dude. You know, so he was a seeker, man.
That's cool, man. And, you know, you mentioned Michael Jackson, and that's another crazy case, and a lot of people speculate that he might have faked his death. And it's also...
Well, here's the thing. Michael Jackson was 100% convinced Elvis faked his own death.
Yes, yes. And he also, apparently...
He told his wife. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, he supposedly was married to Elvis's daughter, which is an interesting connection because they're
exactly.
Such moguls. But your article seems to suggest that might have been a faked marriage or an arranged marriage or something. But it's a strange connection.
Oh, he was just trying to get to it. Absolutely, he was just trying to get some knowledge. He was trying to figure out. He was just obsessed with Elvis, so, you know, the idea of marrying his daughter was, you know, trying to get this information. I'm sure, and then, you know, probably maybe get some good media. It kind of backlit. It didn't work like the way we thought it was going to work. But at least there was one good song out of it. You're Not Alone, fantastic. You know, so, you know, if there was one person who could take their own death, it would be Elvis or Michael Jackson. I mean, who knows? Maybe Michael did. You know, like, you got to think about it. Like, he faked his own death to get out of this, you know, this hellish, you know, contract and all the, you know, Michael Jackson was real. He knew all about the game, like, with the Illuminati music industry, the Zionist control, the...
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he even had, like, they don't care about us. Like, how more plainly can you get? Like, he you know, they tried to destroy him many times with the child, you know, case and everything else. So he definitely had a reason to take his own death as well, you know?
Right, both.
And it's kind of funny that the IRS, like, just like last month, hit his estate with a $700 million tax.
I know, I saw that too. It's...
So they're like, you faked your own death, but you didn't fake this, buddy, you know? So, why, come on, man, like, that's nuts. $700 million, what do they know, you know?
Mm-hmm. And another interesting parallel was that Elvis's funeral was only just a day after his death. Michael Jackson's was pretty close after his death, and both staffs were fired before their death.
Yep. Yeah, everything basically happened to Elvis. The weird scenarios happened with Michael Jackson as well. Like, totally strange, totally strange.
Yeah.
You know, and so with Elvis, it's the 900-pound, you know, copper coffin that they somehow put together in a day, and they got him there, and everyone said it had air conditioning, and it was cool, and the body was like a wax stubble that didn't look like the Elvis looked, you know, it was 50 pounds overweight and everything, and, you know, the sideburns were falling off, it looked like it was melting,
it's trippy, man.
So crazy.
And in the case of Michael Jackson, there's a shot of the stretcher, and it looks like the body on the stretcher moves, and it's like, what happened there?
The helicopter. Yep. Exactly. Like, what is going on? but we should even be surprised. I mean, look at 9/11. Like, they reported, like, in what, BBC, like, Tower 7 fell 15 minutes before it did or something.
Right. We see these mistakes happening time and time again. We see the same approach to control and the same mistakes happening, yet so many people are still in such denial. But, you know, we're looking back at one of the first secret societies of Egypt, and now we're bringing it up to 9/11. It seems like this control grid might be the same as it always has been, and it might have started with this crazy serpent cult.
Yeah, and you know what's funny? The famous quote, "Nothing is new under the sun."
Mm-hmm.
That's the Akhenaten quote.
It's trippy, man.
Think about how deep that is.
Yeah. Well, man, I never gave much thought to the parallels between Elvis and Michael Jackson until your articles, and how weird it is that Michael Jackson, at least on the surface, married Elvis's daughter. But man, it is great stuff. It's awesome that you are going to be turning that content into a full-on book. And I love how you aren't pigeonholing yourself.
I'm gonna get a copy.
Yeah, it's...
Thank you, man. Yeah, I just go with the flow, and, you know, some catches me, some sounds interesting. I'm into so many different things that, you know, there's always something fresh in, you know.
Absolutely.
There's always some weird stuff. Like, every time I look into it, like, wait a minute, you know, and I happen to be a good researcher, so I might as well just, you know, put that to good use. Yeah.
See, I'm lazy, man. I love the different content, but I don't do the research. I sit here and I talk to people like you, do the research. And then when I get sick of Egypt, I talk about MKUltra. And then when I'm sick of that, we talk about cryptids or Bigfoot. So it's great.
Yeah, you got the easy job, man. You get to talk to people. Man. That's awesome.
Yeah, so it's great that you're out there, man. I love that you're tackling all this radically different stuff. It makes shows like this one fun. But... Before we go, would you like to tell the people about your blog or your book or anything else you have coming up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can. My blog spot is xavianhayes.blogspot.com. That's where you can find all the, you know, the cool articles and different essays, all free, of course. I have an online metaphysical library if you want to, read about MKUltra or ancient Indian texts or any type of, you know, metaphysical, esoteric history books, UFO stuff. There's a bunch of ebooks there, video interviews and lectures. It's all free too at xavianvision.com. And I'm on Facebook, you know, add me on Facebook, ask me a question. The Elvis book's coming out around Christmas, and I have a novel on Errol Flynn who's coming out in, I think, a couple months. So always busy.
Right on, man. Well, it's been great talking to you. But thanks for coming on the show, man. The book has been awesome. Aliens in Ancient Egypt, The Brotherhood of the Serpent and the Secrets of the Nile Civilization. I definitely recommend it. And yeah, man, take care of yourself out there.
Thank you for having me on. Thanks for reading. And I look forward to talking to you again.
There we have it, folks. Back in the saddle, another one in the bag, and I hope you enjoyed that. I wish Xavier had a slightly better microphone, but we made it work. Please consider donating if you enjoy the show. I'm determined not to change the way I do things, but I'm starting to have a little bit of a struggle. You can see how much I take in by the money bombs, and $400 or $500 a month really isn't enough. But let's share the show, tell your friends, rise to the top of the conspiratorial charts, and I'm sure it'll all be okay in the end. Thanks for sticking with me on this ride, folks. You're the best there is, and I'll see you next week. Your move, Elvis.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out because I love you too much, baby. Why can't you see what you're doing to me? When you don't believe a word I say, we can't go on together with suspicious. Say hello. Would I still see suspicion in your eyes? But here we go again, asking where I've been. You can't see the tears are real, I'm crying. Don't let her go.